Many people thought the Share Your Embarrassment tour was over, but it was just dormant. We are really excited to announce that right now, tickets are on sale for the streaming Cyboctacular. We filmed our Hollywood show last year, and it's going to be streaming starting May 16th and available for a couple of weeks after that to anyone that holds a ticket. And if you have a Max Fun membership, you can get your ticket at a discount. Just check your inbox for an email for Max Fun with that code. If you aren't and would like to see the show, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets today. These shows are really fun. We put a lot of work into high-quality production values. And if you get a VIP ticket, we can even meet face-to-face over the internet. Get your tickets today at greatestgentour.com, and we'll see you on May 16th.
Captain! Captain! Signatures detected!
Shields up!
Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. Adam, you got us in. You got us into the premiere.
You didn't think we were going to get in.
I didn't even bother asking. I had a lot on my mind.
If you have to ask, you probably don't deserve to go. That's been a governing principle for me for my entire life, basically. For some reason, I asked.
Yeah, I was amazed that you asked. I figured if I didn't, nobody would. And then I just...
Oh, but that's fair. Because you know you and you know me.
Yeah. This also seemed to be a little bit like I feel like they were more generous with the access on this one. It seemed like there were a lot of people in.
Have we said what we're talking about? So there was a virtual premiere for the first episode of Star Trek Discovery, and up until its premiere date, I was compulsively checking my email box. I was telling you to do the same. I was like, you know, when we got the virtual premiere invitation to Lower Decks, I thought we were on the list.
Yeah.
And here I am with my fucking podcast dick in my hand outside the velvet rope going, like, do we get to go to this party?
Can I come in?
Yeah, and I didn't think we were gonna get the invitation. And in fact, I thought we had done something wrong because when we went to that first virtual premiere, I mean, we didn't do anything bad. It was fine. It was fine and fun, and we had a good time. But I was like, did we fuck that up somehow? And now we're not invited to things anymore? Turns out, all I needed to do was just elevate the email again. And they were like, oh, yeah, you're going to get a link in a half an hour. And so we were sent those links.
Squeaky wheels, oil, etc. And then I was like, right. Oh, well, if it was that easy, we should have asked for them for Bill Tilly and Rob Schulte also. That would have been nice of us.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, this is every once in a while, like, you're confronted with this awful choice. And I think we've run into this in real life, even at like Sketchfest, for example, is like, God, we kind of have people with us, but we've been invited to a thing, and it's awkward to ask to bring other people to
right.
things that seem to be very small and intimate. So like, this was not that.
Right.
But
this is just a live stream.
A live stream with individual codes. So like, the way it works is like, we asked for links to the premiere, we received the links, and we were given individual passwords, and then we were granted access to this portal. And the portal gave us the show, and then a virtual after party with different areas you could go to with like trivia and a bar, a virtual bar, and like a Q&A with cast type people.
It's pretty rad.
They're doing the best they can with all that's really possible. Like, look, this is the Zoom qualification of our lives, basically.
Yeah.
is what's happening here.
Speaking of Q&As with regard to Star Trek, you also went to that Star Trek for Joe Biden campaign event this week.
I did.
Which I couldn't attend, but it seemed like you and our our friends from DC were in there cutting it up. I had to pick my wife up from something and I was in traffic for like an hour. And when I got there, I had like over 70 text messages on my phone.
I'm sorry. That sucks.
This is like, I'm going to declare text message bankruptcy right here, right now. Get it filed.
Our best friends of DeSoto, Sam from Washington, D.C., bought a grip of tickets.
Yeah.
He did basically exactly the opposite of what you and I were discussing at the top of the show. He got extras for friends. What a guy.
What a guy. Yeah. So these are friends that work in politics, and they actually were really kind and gave us a bunch of basically free, like, prestige level consulting on how to set up our greatest voters fund and like what kind of language we wanted to use in the messaging. And it was really cool because we had like a little Google Doc of like the text we were going to have on that. And we invited them to it and watched them just like whip it into shape. Like it was really exciting. And I've been completely blown away by how many donations the Greatest Voters Fund has gotten. It's bit.ly/greatestvoters if you haven't already gone. But what was the campaign event like? It was like cast members shilling for the candidate, right?
It was like a crazier Zoom call than the Discovery premiere because it was like 16 cast members.
Wow.
All in one frame. And a moderator, and Marina Sirtis took it over. I just want to say that right now.
Hell like, yeah. Like
she got the rebound, and she was throwing elbows under the hoop.
Wow.
And
like, potted plant no more.
It was an unrestrained performance by Marina Sirtis.
That's rad.
Who was like throwing haymakers at Sir Patrick Stewart for not changing his citizenship the way that Marina Sirtis did. Like,
wow.
Like she kind of went in on him in a pretty fun way. That's just one example of how she was during the whole thing. She was a delight.
Damn.
But so many Star Trek luminaries were a part of it. A lot of little breakout sessions, a lot of fun, political celebrity hosts.
Was I correct in thinking that every cast was represented by at least one actor?
Yeah, it's true.
That's cool. Yeah.
Infinite cast combinations for all of these breakout panels. It was a couple hours. It was really interesting. And I mean, an unsurprising position for many people involved with Star Trek and in and around the Star Trek community. I think we're all thinking a lot alike about the direction our country needs to go, and the feelings were emphatic.
That's good. That's great.
And I hope it was convincing for some people. It's hard to tell. Like, this seems like it may have been a situation where we're just talking to ourselves. But if you're interested in Star Trek and you're on the fence and you attended the thing, maybe it moved your needle, and I hope it did, because I think Star Trek values are specific and good, and in this election, fairly obvious.
Yeah. I'm hoping everybody listening has already registered and maybe even voted, because early voting is already underway. You and I have both already voted. But if you have early voting as an option in your state, I would really encourage it, because it's going to be a challenge on election day for sure in a lot of places. And you can kind of get out ahead of it by making a plan and making sure you execute that plan, making sure your vote gets in and gets counted is so important.
So back to the virtual premiere.
Yeah.
So Mary Wiseman's getting interviewed after the first episode drops. And this alert klaxon plays and something comes down over the screen.
Whoa.
And I'm like, oh God, like I'm finally getting kicked out of this thing. Also, by the way, you and I are never given names at this thing. It's always user number 31 or something. Like everyone else gets a name in the chat window.
Oh.
I'm such an asshole, like complaining about the circumstances of the free thing I was invited to.
Yeah,
but
check your fucking privilege, Adam.
But anyway, I'm in there yucking it up as user number 31 when the door on the thing closes and I'm thinking it's over, and instead, because it happened mid-sentence, Mary Wiseman's answering a question and then the screen just locks.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, we've decided to show you the second episode of season one, and that's coming up next.
Damn.
And like 30 minutes later, there were several interviews after that. We got to see the second episode too.
So you have seen two episodes of Star Trek Discovery. I, on the other hand, have only seen this first one. So now I'm consumed with jealousy.
Yeah, I saw the first two, and we saw the first one together, which was pretty great. Well, we watched it yesterday, we watched it again today, and now we're on the mic to do the very first episode of the third season of Star Trek Discovery. Let's get into it, Ben. It's season 3, episode 1. It's called The Hope Is You, part 1.
This opens with a little recap of the previous season, reminding us where we've been. And I was very grateful because I feel like I've had a lot of Star Trek intake since we last were with these characters. And also grateful for it because it just reminded me how much I love these characters. Like, there's a lot of Saru in the recap, and I just hadn't thought about Saru much. And I was like, oh, Saru, I love that guy. It was like being reunited with old friends in a way.
There's some stakes whiplash to be had here too, because when you get this package, this pre-roll package before the episode, the stakes were so high in the second to last and last episode of season two. I mean, the stakes of this episode could not come even close to that by design.
I love the way they toy with that, though. We finish that package and then we have like a lonely man going through his morning routine with his hologram bird clock and his bed that is made out of nanoparticles or something, brushing his teeth in a holographic mirror.
He works from home, just like us. His bed is in the same room as his office.
He doesn't have to hang blankets across the doorway because his wife was on a Zoom call in the other room, though. That's our purview here in the 21st century.
Let me ask you a question. If you're your own boss, is 8 a.m. a late morning for someone who works every day? Like back when I used to work a real job, I was up before 7 and I was out the door by 7:30. But I guess if your morning routine goes as fast as this guy's does, he's from bed to work in a couple of minutes.
And all his job is like looking at a holographic map of the galaxy that says no signals found. So
yeah,
he's got a very chill existence, I think.
I've got some thoughts about this guy that I'm going to share at the end.
Okay.
Some dark thoughts. So.
Oh, wow.
But we don't come back here for a very long time.
Yeah, we don't.
Because we have cut directly to a Star Wars-style space battle in a debris field. And it's between characters named Book and Cosmo, who looks vaguely Iridian, but I guess is not Iridian.
He's got that shock of curly hair on the top of his head, and he's always coming through doors in kind of a chaotic way.
God, the camera moves around so fast in space around this debris field, but if you pause and you enhance, Ass Man is the license plate on the back of this guy's ship.
Yeah, pretty good. He was actually almost late to this space battle because he was trying to get like a discount on an air conditioning unit at the mall, and then he forgot where he parked.
He's a high school graduate.
This space fight gets interrupted because a giant space butthole appears out of nowhere from which Michael Burnham, and in her Red Angel suit, shoots through and collides with Book's ship.
Yeah, Book sees this coming and can't quite get out of the way. It's the last thing he needs, right? He's getting shots licked at his ship, and then time travel movie collides with car chase movie in a really fun way.
This scene is so shocking. It shocks Book, it shocks Michael Burnham, and it shocks us because she hits the windshield of Book's ship so hard, she's instantly killed, And then we go to credits.
I did not think that season three was going to be as short as this.
And then we come back up and then like the chat window appears and Alex Kurtzman's like, look, COVID really changed how we had to do production. We had to really scale back the scope of season three. And we hope you liked meeting this new character, new couple of characters here. Hopefully we'll be able to bring you season four.
Hopefully this was strong enough for us to be renewed for a fourth season.
Yeah, I did not see it coming, and neither did Michael Burnham, clearly.
She is tumbling toward the surface of this planet and has to like reboot the entire system and reboots just in time to survive her crash landing. I wondered why Cosmo broke off pursuit. I guess he just assumed that Book's ship was totaled in the crash and that the cargo was no good anymore. They have a brief exchange about why Cosmo's shooting at Book, and it's something about that cargo belongs to me, and Book replying she belongs to herself. So that cargo is a she, but we don't know much more than that.
No.
But yet Michael Burnham waking up from her crash, she has she barfed some water, which I thought was an interesting choice. It was not a can of Campbell soup that she spits out of her mouth. It was clear.
It made me think about the abyss. Like I wondered if her atmosphere in there was liquid in some way.
There's more than one part of this episode that made me think about the abyss. And I'm glad you brought that up because this is definitely one of those moments.
The territorial shots on this planet are straight out of a David Lean film. And I wanted to begin calling attention to that right away. Like the cinematographer of this episode is named Glenn Keenan. And he will go on to do several more episodes of this season of Discovery. But he's also been on camera for two of the Short Treks episodes.
Oh, nice.
He has done 17 episodes of Star Trek Discovery as a director of photography. So he's getting a lot to play with in Iceland.
Yeah, no kidding. This stuff looks amazing. I mean, this is, they showed a lot of like early images of this land, and it's like, it's so cool to see Star Trek get the kind of budget that you need to go do international production like this. I mean, this has long been the purview of Star Wars, you know, like go to a totally exotic location and set it up as your alien planet. But this just, it just looks amazing. And it's like, it's so cool to see Star Trek characters walking around on the surface of an alien planet and it doesn't look like Burbank.
Right. You know? It looks practically alien in a really like an enviable way. Like I wish I could shoot something there. It just seems awesome. I've never been, have you?
No, I would love to.
Yeah. Michael manages to get to her feet and the suit takes itself off, like as if like it chooses to do that. And it's fun because it kind of steps back off of her body and then stands there erect. And Michael like goes to the back of it and rips off an emergency kit like you'd find in the trunk of a car. And checks it out. Anytime you time travel, you're going to want to bring one of these with you. It's got some road flares, a kind bar, and
like
one
bucks.
Of those reflective blankets. Yeah, $100 and fives.
She goes through like the full range of human emotions in this like 5-minute sequence. Like the painful struggle to like unbury herself, the desperation to figure out where she is and if there's other life. Like she asks, you know, the suit to scan for life forms and it says that there's lots of life forms detected and it's like the peak of triumph and joy.
It reminded me a little bit of the end of Gravity, like getting to her feet and like talking herself through it. And like, I wonder how much of the end of Gravity influenced this opening sequence for this episode, that fall to the planet.
Yeah.
The rising up. Pretty great.
I mean, not every episode should or can be like this, but I think that this is a really amazing episode for her and a virtuosic performance because she goes everywhere. in this episode.
I was happy to cash my ticket on how quickly Sinequa Martin Green would scream at top volume. The over-under was 3 episodes. I bet the under. Uh-huh. And I got that one out of the way.
Yeah, that was a nice payout.
Yeah. No one screams like SMG. She's no. just the best.
She's got the pipes for it. It's an amazing moment, and it's scream laughter and mm-hmm. triumph that I wondered, is she interpreting that as life forms meaning intelligent life? Like there's a city? Because there is a city here, but I like the shorthand of like multiple life forms detected. Like I have watched a lot of Star Trek, surprise, surprise. And I was not expecting that reaction.
Well, I think it's the pre-roll package that telegraphs the significance of this, because in the pre-roll, we're reminded that for Control to succeed in its mission, right. it will have killed all life in the universe everywhere. And so for there to be multiple life forms that Michael Burnham finds would suggest that the mission of destroying Control was successful.
That's such a great point. And I think that this is a bit me just trying to excuse my having not had that at front of mind as I sat down to watch this episode. But I think that was a little bit undercut by the little butterfly landing and the other bug eating mm-hmm. it in the foreground in one of these shots. Like, we already know that there's life forms on this planet. And I think that maybe that moment would have been more effective and more specific to the previous episode if they had not animated those little bugs into the foreground in that scene.
Right. This is a show, though, that crafts those pre-rolls at the episode to come. Like,
that's
very
true.
Specifically, with a lot of intentionality. Unfortunately, the wormhole is collapsing, and this is like a moment of reverie that's kind of interrupted. Michael Burnham snaps into action, and I know that the plan was always to send the suit back through the wormhole to signal Spock and Pike and company that they made it safely. And then the suit self-destructs on the other side. But man, when she sent this thing back through the hole, I was like, you're going to want that suit, Michael. Like, can't you take the helmet? Can't you strip, like, take a couple of arms off of the suit, like anything.
Yeah.
Anything of value off of the suit, because to be out there without it on an alien planet, like, ratcheted up the danger level big time. I think you see this on her face a little bit, like the feeling of being marooned right after the wormhole collapses is very present in the moments that followed.
She is really scattered.
And the pain sets in as if like the adrenaline is worn off of that fall. Like she's clearly in pain and like she's got to like psych herself up to even stand and start walking. It's a real thing.
She has to kind of like remind herself who she is, right? Like she kind of like is saying everything out loud to like center herself. What's your name? What's your rank? What's your serial number? What's the stuff in this kit?
My mouth tastes like clear barf because I've been time traveling and for no other reason. I bet she could use that guy's toothbrush from the cold open. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Just
yeah.
Stand in front of a thing, get it done.
Makes you kind of wonder what it's like to barf in 3188 or whatever, because like, I don't know if laser would totally like clear you out the way a mouthful of sudsy toothpaste would.
God, the first dump after time travel has got to be so satisfying.
So she starts walking toward the smoke rising on the horizon, representing the crashed ship that she bonked when she came into this reality.
I love that she has a tricorder, but she uses Dead Reckoning to head out there. Good for her.
Yeah. She's got some pride, you know?
Yeah.
She's like walking up to his ship. It cloaks itself, and then he's swinging this thing at her. He kind of gives himself up, though, because he does that thing where he goes like, "Argh!" to swing the wrench, and she hears him and ducks out of the way. And they have a pretty good new era Star Trek fight here on the beach.
Here's another merch idea for the Star Trek Industrial Complex. This thing he's wielding around looks like one of those, like a bottle opener you buy at a tourist town that has like two ends for opening bottles.
Yeah.
Like, why not just have a giant bottle opener like this with the Star Trek logo on it?
That sounds great. Would buy.
$20. Done. I love his boomerang knife.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was fun. Are they fighting or are they flirting was a question that I had during this scene. And I think it's important to consider this question in relation to how much danger you feel like Michael is in this moment. Because I don't know about you, but I never felt like she was in danger in this fight.
I didn't feel like she was in danger, but I just think that that's because she can handle herself. Like, this guy is not her equal in terms of fighting.
Right.
But I didn't get flirt because he's so hostile to her initially. Like, he does not want to know her name. He does not want to make her acquaintance. He doesn't want her excuses for why she came out of a space butthole and fucked his ship up. He's pissed. I mean, he's pissed in the way of like a person that just got rear-ended on the highway, you know, like you just fucking ruined my day.
I think it's flirting just because I come from the school of my mind and heart permanently being in sixth grade, and you're mean to the person you actually like.
and you see that constantly reinforced in movies and television where two extraordinarily beautiful people are on screen being mean to each other, but then secretly that's sexual tension, but you don't totally know what sexual tension is yet because you're in middle school.
Why are relationships so difficult nowadays? I wonder why. Anyway, this is not Terralysium, Ben. This is HEMA. So Michael Burnham is not where she wants to be. And Book isn't interested in giving directions to a person that is asking for directions.
But she kind of puts on the puppy dog eyes. She explains that she like really, really, really needs help. And he appears to take some pity on her. He lets her into the ship. The ship seems very uncrashed on the inside.
Yeah, looks pretty good. There's a lot of wood grain and high tech, sort of a dune kind of look about it that I could appreciate.
Yeah, that's kind of a look I'm going for with my new office. Kind of a high tech wood grain
mixing
situation.
Materials.
Yeah. A lot of nano filaments that, you know, come to life when you hover your hand over the controls. I'm just kind of trying to do it all.
You know what I loved about this tour of the ship scene is that Pelican cases still exist in the year 3188. Buy that Pelican stock right now, man.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a need for Pelican cases.
A friend of mine pointed out to me that the containers that the tools made by the Festool company appear a lot in the Expanse television program, and they're not even like putting a layer of gray spray paint on them or anything. It's just like literally a tan tool container with a green closure, like right off the shelf.
Wow. The Festool, the company made famous by our friends at This Old House.
Right.
Pretty thrilled to be here in Detroit to work on a house of our own.
Michael Burnham does not know Book's name yet, but she does get to know his cat, Grudge. She's a Maine Coon. She's a big old cat.
Grudge reminded me of a cat that a friend of me and my wife had. Anna was this cat's name. Anna was 35 pounds.
Wow.
And I'm going to send you a picture of Anna.
That is a chunky cat.
Just an enormous feline was Anna.
There's nothing funnier than the face of a cat being held up by a proud cat dad.
Yeah, it's weird. We get to know Grudge a little bit more than Book, but we know from this scene how pissed off Book is and why. And it's because his dilithium crystal is cracked. I guess he only has one.
Right.
And he has no recrystallizer. And not only that, he's on a schedule. He's got this cargo he's got to take to a place at a certain time, and he has no way to do it. It's a real problem.
So they're going to have to go trade for dilithium at the Mercantile, which is a settlement, and they're going to have to walk because the ship is out of commish. And so they take a what appears to be a very long walk across a pretty amazing alien landscape.
They take what I'm going to call an exposition walk. Just enough time to give us a little more backstory.
Yeah. So here's the backstory. At some point, something happened called the burn. The burn was when most, but not all, dilithium spontaneously exploded. And you can do the math on what happened to all starships everywhere. But there's still a little bit of dilithium, and so you trade for it at the mercantile.
Whenever all things everywhere are destroyed, people for some reason blame me. It's pretty unfair.
I mean, it's a reputation that I don't feel I've earned, because only all of one thing everywhere was destroyed by me, and that does not constitute a pattern.
In case you're wondering, and I know you are, I am still alive in the year 3188. Made a couple of improvements to my Malibu beach house. Still married. My lovely wife, Roshan.
She disappeared at the end of that one episode, but the second they got out of there, I brought her right back. I couldn't stay away. I love Roshan.
I hope and wonder that we see the flashback scene of the burn happening.
Yeah.
It seems like a show that would show that. Because when all your dilithium crystals spontaneously explode, it takes all the ships with them.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have a Federation without warp-capable ships. Or is it? Because that's the counterpoint that Michael Burnham comes down on at the end, that the Federation is more than just ships and exploration. It's a way of life,
right?
Book. What you do is you find an ensign to work beneath you, and then an ensign below them. maybe you find some friends and family to be a lieutenant and a captain and a commander, and before you know it, you get a Federation.
If you got enough ensigns in your downline, they'll give you a Mercedes.
But the shitty part about your free starship that you get for rising up the ranks of the Federation is you have to have that decal in the back window that says, ask me about the Federation.
And it's like a bone stock version of that starship, right? Like, it's like, sure, technically it has the Mercedes logo on the hood, but it's like, I didn't even know they made this car with a cloth interior, and yet.
Yeah. Book has kind of conflicting feelings about Starfleet and gestures to Michael Burnham's comm badge cleavage, and was like, you might want to cover that up before we get to the mercantile.
You know, wearing that flag on that jacket, looking the way you do, you're asking for trouble around here, friend.
Yeah, it's not that he's judgmental of it, but I kind of think that a lot of people are, and that, like, people that rep Starfleet are seen as kind of like starry-eyed, unrealistic idealists, because the burn happened like 120 years ago, and Starfleet has not been a thing for a long time, and people that rep Starfleet are kind of living in a fantasy world from Book's perspective.
Like, it's kind of fun to go to a Starfleet relay station for brunch, but, like, you don't want to stick around and get the talking to from their people. It's like a real sales job after that.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I mean, like, the second they have your address, you will never stop getting pamphlets in the mail. And then you get a copy of their book.
And then John Hodgman is collecting a bunch of your ephemera and doing bits about it.
Yeah.
We get, I think, one of the first Gaussian blurs to commercial break that I can remember seeing on this show.
Wow.
What a transition.
I got the version of CBS All Access without the commercials, so it didn't even register. It just looked like a transition to me.
I've got that too, but, like, the blur to black seemed like something I would drag into a timeline in Premiere, you know?
Yeah.
It seemed unique.
It's nice looking. Well, Adam, the Mercantile is a business started on a hip street in a major American city by a trust fund kid that sells, like, a lot of, leather keychain fobs and kind of overly expensive throw blankets for your couch, and like beard oil and stuff.
Right. They took a neighborhood that already had a culture and they displaced it with their new one, and all the property values went up.
Right.
Really sad story. I love that the ramp to the mercantile goes out of the side of the screen. Like, we have no idea how long the ramp is that goes there, but it is, I don't know, miles?
It's like, it looks like there's like an elevator up to it in the wide shot, and then you have to walk like an entire mile after the elevator to get into the mercantile, which is cantilevered out over a part of the city that has like less skyscrapers than the rest.
Yeah, you're gonna need a pass to get into the mercantile, and there's sort of a subcutaneous ID checking process that happens here. Book has one, Michael Burnham doesn't, and that's a real problem for the Andorian and the Orion doormen there. These are a couple of guys who I feel like have been fully sketched out as characters. Like, pages and pages of backstory exist for Ithic and Ithor,
yeah.
But what we get are a couple of scenes of them just like, I love them.
Yeah, they're great.
Their banter's great.
It's kind of a surprise to Michael Burnham that Andorians and Orions would be fucking with each other at all.
Yeah.
And they get past them pretty quickly by showing off the antiques that Michael is carrying in her phaser, tricorder, etc.
I don't know what that is, and if I did, I wouldn't care.
Michael's like, Mark Wahlberg's in there right now waiting to take a look at this.
And Book does that thing of like, do you really want to go to your boss and tell them that you turned away this woman carrying all this valuable shit because she didn't have subcutaneous arm patch or whatever? And the way the mercantile works is that there's kind of the guys that run it, this Orion and Andorian dude make deals with these couriers, of which Book is one, and then they get paid in dilithium for going and getting the stuff.
The way Book explains the scene and how things work inside the mercantile, it seems like a place and an economy where Ferengi would really thrive. And I think because we don't see any Ferengi, we can hypothesize that we're very far away from any that would exist in this time, or that they're all dead.
Maybe they all happen to be chewing on a piece of dilithium when the burn happened.
Yeah. So Book walks Michael to where they're ready to part ways. And, you know, a deal's a deal. Michael Burnham gives Book the tricorder and then is ensnared in a Wonder Woman lasso of a stasis beam. And she's been Landoed.
Yeah.
Book Landos the hell out of her. It's a double cross.
He fucked her over.
And because this is CBS All Access, Michael Burnham says that. You fucked me over, Book. What the fuck?
It seems like kind of a long time goes by before Ithic and Ithor like come find her. She's still tied up, and Book had led her to the vault of the mercantile, and so they assumed that she was trying to like hijack stuff from the vault, and they're like, "What? How the fuck did you even think you were going to get away? Even if your dumb plan to get in had worked?" And she's not making with the answers, so they bring in what I'm going to call a jazz drone. Gives her a puff of something, and it's kind of a truth serum, if you will. You and I texted each other when this moment happened. One word, Adam, and I'm sure Rob will edit in that word right here.
Damn.
Sonequa Martin-Green is funny, naturally funny. And this began a conversation you and I had offline, which was like, she rarely gets to show this gear. And I'm just going to say it right now, like, the campaign to put SMG on SNL starts now.
Hashtag SMG number four SNL. Get it going on social media. We want to see SMG host SNL.
She would kick so much ass.
Hashtag SMG for SNL.
There is a technique deployed here, Ben, that I also wanted to talk to you about, which just delighted me. So when you work with video, you're often required to smooth the motion that the camera has. Like if you're going handheld,
yeah,
and you don't have a stabilizer, like an actual physical stabilizer on a camera, oftentimes when you bring your footage into an edit, you'll smooth out that motion to take off, you know, some of the rougher bumps. But deployed in this scene, what's happened is that you've clicked Sonequa Martin-Green's nose to lock the motion tracking onto her. And so the frame follows her nose around.
Yeah.
It's such a great technique to show what being drugged up is like. It's really well done.
I also feel like they put the settings of the stabilizing effect up a lot so that it like kind of jellos the image a little bit. It's like warped in a way that is a little unrealistic. And that's something that you're trying to avoid at all costs normally.
Right.
But here they're using it like it's like a Hendrix letting the distortion on his amp be an aesthetic choice.
Right. What delighted me was like seeing what I would consider a mistake be used for a benefit. It's really fun.
It's really cool looking. She goes on quite the little rant.
I'm going to kill you pretty soon.
One thing I noticed her saying was, don't give whatever this is to Tilly.
Who knows what would happen? Because this is like a Tilly effect.
Totally.
This drug.
They get out of her, though, that Book has some cargo that is valuable and heat sensitive. So they take her with them when they beam to find him. And this turns into kind of a standoff with them and her and Book and a bunch of gendarmes in the mercantile. And this is when Cosmo shows up and he wants permission to kill Book. And they are a little scandalized by the fact that Cosmo figured out a way to get a gun into their mercantile, which, you know, we had a whole scene establishing that was hard to do.
Things aren't going great for either of them.
This is a perfect opportunity for Michael and Book to make eye contact with each other and realize that the plan is going to be start throwing haymakers at everyone and steal guns and dual wield and just like escape.
These phasers look like sock 'em bopper phasers to me that just fit over your fist.
Yeah, I like that.
The elegant design. But it's so hard to hold anything straight out in your arm for any length of time that, like, when I was watching the actors work with these, it doesn't matter how light these phasers are, you're going to get so tired doing scene after scene, take after take, holding these things straight out.
This is a pretty great gunfight. I think that they have a lot more work to do with this, but so far have made a lot of fun choices about what 1,000 years after the events of the first two seasons might look like in the Star Trek universe. One thing that happens is like a holographic kiosk gets hit and it turns into like a geyser of like nanoparticles or something. Like this like weird foam comes out of it everywhere.
Yeah.
I just love that like the mess that's being made is like a totally weird future mess, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that too. We'll never know what was in that pipe.
Stuff is breaking in all kinds of weird, unexpected ways. Michael and Book are a pretty good gunfight team and managed to turn this into not just a gunfight, but also a dilithium heist. Her experience with the drugs is starting to wear off because of all the adrenaline. And she spots a tray full of dilithium crystals and goes and like sweeps them into a bag and they get out of there using Book's like portable personal transporter device.
It's a weird version of a car chase because it's a transport chase where Book and Michael Burnham jump and then their assailants follow them momentarily after, and then they jump again and again, and it's a great way to see a bunch of different scenes in Iceland for sure. Yeah,
totally.
And what's great is because they're going to different parts of the planet, every part they go to is like magically lit It's the perfect time of day to shoot wherever they're at.
It's sunset behind a waterfall, and then it's like overcast, gray sand in every direction place, and then it's like golden hour cliffside.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of different fun looks. I love that there's a Morn chasing them.
Yeah.
I've never seen a Morn move this fast.
Yeah, there were a bunch of Lurians in the Mercantile too, and a bunch of different weird kinds of aliens.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a Lurian, there's got to be a Ferengi close by, right?
You'd think. You'd really think so. Speaking of jumping, their last jump is off a cliff, and underwater is where they appear. This was a technique that Book used to obscure their eventual location, but it's not going to last forever, crucially. It just buys them a little bit of time. Time to dry off.
Time to dry off. Time for Michael Burnham to punch him in the nose. And
time for Book to take off his shirt.
Yeah. And do a prayer to the water plant. Very strange moment here. He has some like little iridescent things that light up on his forehead, and he's able to coax a plant out of the water. Another the abyss looking moment. And this is some kind of, I don't know, space aloe that he wants Michael Burnham to rub in the cuts on her arm from where she was shot.
By the end of the episode, you understand that Book is kind of a Temple Grandin type with plants and animals. He can really speak to all of them.
Yeah. And you know, if the plant didn't impress you, then getting back to the ship and getting dropped on by these mercantile dudes again will, because the cargo that he's transporting is a dino. It's that dino from the trailer.
The angle makes it look like there's a poop emoji up in this enclosure, though.
Yeah, that's true.
This is an iridescent manatee known as a trance worm. And we get a really fun Ark of the Covenant opening moment when Book is like, close your eyes, Marion.
Yeah.
Because when this thing comes out, it hypnotizes their assailants and just starts eating them one by one.
Yeah. A lot of them get eaten up, including Aethor and Ithic. Some of their henchmen are able to get away, but Michael and Book are in the clear after this, and they get to meet the trance worm. The trance worm likes to, it's like a dog, likes to meet people by putting them all the way inside of it.
I thought it was a little on the nose when Book introduces the trance worm and then Darude's Sandstorm starts playing as it ate all of the guys one by one. I mean, it's a great track, but is it still cool in the year 3188?
Yeah.
Imagine the residuals. After the scene, we're back on Book's ship, and the reason we're there is because of a scene that I think we hopped over earlier. Like, Book and Michael Burnham have a talk where Book obviously pegs her as a time traveler and casually lets it slip that all time travel tech was destroyed and outlawed in the temporal wars. So good luck trying to find another time suit. You don't have another one of those, do you, Michael? You sent your only one back, didn't you?
Yeah.
You really fucked it up.
I mean, she's still just trying to make contact with Discovery, and like he's been sort of leading her along. Like, her whole pretext for going to the Mercantile was get on subspace with the Disco.
Yeah. And Book's had the tech the whole time.
And unfortunately, she can't raise them. She can't get in touch. And there's a pretty amazing moment where she's like, yeah, we actually had to save the entire universe in the past. And like, then coming to this point in time was the only way out. And he's like, wow, well, I guess thanks for saving the future. That was cool.
Book's like, yeah, I guess I can give you a lift. They end up going to a planet where these iridescent manatee live.
Yeah.
Because they've scooped up the guy that they had in the cargo, and they take it back to its home planet, and the waters are just teeming with these iridescent manatees, and it's breeding season, Ben, which means there's about to be a bunch of iridescent cum shooting around in that water.
Book is kind of a one-man space EPA, I would say. Like the this is an endangered species that used to be very widespread, and now there's not that many of them left.
You're not going to need a black light on this planet after after a couple of days.
Yeah, but that's why it was so important to save this trance worm. And yeah, so she's explaining like she's stuck here in the future, but can't make contact with her people. But he has an idea of maybe somebody that could help, and that is the guy that we met at the very beginning of the episode.
That's right. The bookend scene is nigh. Book and Michael Burnham board the remains of a Federation relay station where they find this guy from the beginning. His name is Aditya Sahil, and he's ready to help. He's just, it's another day like the first day we saw. He meets Michael and Book. He scans the system and finds only two Federation ships for that. The Discovery isn't one of them. Michael's like, what the fuck? Like, why can't you get the Discovery on there? And it's because he can only scan short range.
They're not plugged in across lots and lots of star systems because of this warp problem, presumably. I mean, like the potential of the Discovery in a relatively high cost warp environment is starting to really dawn on me, you know, like if they have a unique ability to move around the galaxy, that's even more impressive in this timeline than in the timeline they came from. That's kind of a big deal.
Right. All they need to do is get some floor squeegees in the spore box, get what's his name's remains out of there. They're back in business once the Discovery arrives.
Yeah, it's going to be great. This guy is kind of, he's almost like a monk of Starfleet. He's sort of, he doesn't have a rank, but his father and his father's father were Starfleet people. And he's just kind of been keeping the vigil of hoping a Starfleet person will show up. And like when she introduces herself as Commander Michael Burnham, it is like, I feel like this actor plays this as a religious moment.
I agree. I think there is a costuming language to this guy that feels very monastic as well. Right down to his shoes, Ben. Did you check out the shoes?
They were like
monk straps, baby. Monk straps.
I didn't notice the straps, but
yeah, I see you. I see you, Gersha Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
I love how there's a cultural exchange here happening. So Michael has shown him hers, and now he is going to show her his. And his story is pretty sad. He's got a sting amount of tantric ambition having to do with this flag on his desk. He can't get it up himself because he's not real Starfleet. And so Michael Burnham gives him the gift of a field commission and goes, why don't you go to that wall and blast, buddy? So that flag goes up, and finally this character achieves relief. The flag is raised, the music swells, and that's the end of episode one of season three.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
I think I liked it more having talked it through with you. I think it's an episode filled with great moments. But when I really think about its construction, I think I come down on it like this. Like, backstory isn't story. Otherwise, it would be story. So when we trace the episode from beginning to end, what is it really? Like, Michael Burnham lands. She needs someone, so she finds that person. She needs to exchange something in order to get what she needs. But they return basically to square one at the end, and it's really the bookends that tell the A story, and everything in the middle is sort of elevated B, which is interesting. Like, I think one of the problems with this episode actually stems from the thing that Star Trek Discovery does really well. It is so great at emotional catharsis. that when you have emotionally extreme scenes at the bookends, because you're retroactively understanding the emotion of the beginning by the ending, and then fill the middle with kind of a field commissioned A story, the middle doesn't live up to the potential of the huge emotional swing of its ending. And I know that's not fair. Like, it's not fair to judge the beginning and the middle against the power of the end. But that's what you do, I think, when you make an ending this great. When the music swells and you get that moment of triumph with this guy, the relief of finding other Starfleets, like, it was really emotional for me. But nothing in the rest of the episode lived up to that. You see what I'm trying to say? Like the ending is almost too good for the rest of the episode. And it's unfortunate almost that it's like that.
I mean, I liked what a weird episode it was. I feel like choosing not to have the rest of the cast in this episode was, I hated it, because after seeing that pre-roll, I was like, oh, I can't wait to see what Tilly's up to and Stamets and all the fucking weirdos from the disco. Like, what are we going to find out about all of them? And the fact that this episode, like, withholds that, I feel like, is one of the strongest things about it.
This is a technology that this series does, though. Like, it forces you to wait until you have more puzzle pieces to really render an actual judgment. So, like, it feels impossible to judge the episode in a conventional way, the way we normally would, because there's just so much that isn't there. And that's why I think my did you like portion is, like, I don't want it to come off as negative. It's not. It's just, it made me notice its construction in an interesting way.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, I like it too. You want to see if we have any priority one messages on this episode of The Greatest Discovery?
I hope someone jumped on the P1s, because we've got a brand new series and we've got P1s to pack.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, our first priority one message is from Adam. You're Riker in all the ways, and it is to Allie, my one and only goober. The message goes like this. Love you so much, Allie, my lover with the glorious butt. Thank you so much for introducing me to these podcasts and Star Trek.
Whoa.
I can't think of a better way to celebrate our anniversary than Kevin Uxbridge talking about all the dirty things we are going to do together. Love you, Allie.
Adam and Allie, I can't just talk about one dirty thing we're going to do with each other. I have to talk about all dirty things everywhere.
You know, the thing that happened to Rashaan that I told to Captain Picard was that the Hushnak were responsible for her death, but what I was too ashamed to say was that she died during a freak sex accident where I became a little too involved in myself in that exact moment, and things became very dangerous for Rashaan in a way that I regret.
Something that destroyed all life on the planet that we inhabited, I blamed unfairly on the Hushnak, when really it was my own reaction to that ass.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, mind your climax.
And we have another priority one message here. It is from Future Daniels, and it's to double dumbass on you, Daniels. This is for Ben and Adam. And it goes like this. I can prove I'm from the future. A Disco Season 3 cameo will make you cry. New Worlds is a joy. And the less said about Section 31, the better. There'll be times when you want to give up, but fear not. Your best work is ahead of you, and Enterprise is some of the best pod you've ever given. P.S. Not sure if it's happened yet, but you'll never find out if that angry P1 was from Rick Berman.
Ooh.
Wow. I can't remember if we had an angry P1 or not yet.
Yeah, maybe it's coming.
I mean, Rick Berman's money spends, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you are Rick Berman and angry, you can get a Priority One message by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and we really appreciate it.
The merch item that I want to design and sell is the bumper sticker that says, I'm Rick Berman, and I'm angry.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! I suppose I'm going to give it to Cosmo, because I feel like Cosmo kind of fucks shit up in that he is clever and crafty enough to get the gun into the mercantile, but then completely shows his ass by pulling that gun in a very public part of the mercantile on Book. I feel like Cosmo could have gotten a lot of like way bigger shit for his trouble sneaking that gun in there, and instead is focused on some kind of retribution with Book. So he is my Edward Larkin for this episode. How about you?
I couldn't decide between Ethor and Ithic. Can I make them both my Edward Larkin?
I think they're a package deal.
All right, I'm going to do that. I really like both of them. I like both of them together. RSVP, Ethor and Ithic. We hardly knew you.
Killing Darth Maul in episode one. What are you doing?
They each have character Bibles like 40 pages long, and now they're dead. So good work.
Too bad.
Yeah, big fun. Liked them quite a bit. And if they're a sign of ancillary characters to come, then really liking this universe.
Yeah. Adam, tell me about what we've got coming up on The Greatest Discovery, because you have seen episode two. Is there a way you can characterize it without being spoilery?
I think I can. I don't remember seeing the preview, but...
There's no preview on the end of the episode, as far as I can tell.
Here's what I'll say about episode two. The people that you missed in episode one, you will see again.
Oh, good. I'm hoping to see them again.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the cast of Star Trek Discovery will return in season three of Star Trek Discovery, and that the next episode is that episode.
If you do feel like that was a spoiler, write into go fuck yourself at maxfunkenstein.sex.
Yeah, that's the place. Wow. Well, that was a giant cat of an episode, a premiere episode from you and me. Pretty excited to get back on the disco horse here with you.
Yeah, we got a dozen more episodes before we're done with this season, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too. Good start.
We're going to leave it with Rob's From Here.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. The show is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusa, who happens to have a wonderfully helpful and awesome cooking channel on YouTube. Go check it out. If you're looking for more Trek, check out our plethora of episodes in the back catalog. There's a lot to discover. Don't forget you can now follow us on Twitter and Instagram under the handles Greatest Trek. Those accounts are run by the great card daddy Bill Tilly. Thanks, Bill. If you'd like to support this podcast, make sure that you head to MaximumFun.org/join, where you will get all of our bonus episodes, as well as all of the bonus content brought to you by Maximum Fun. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.